Podcasten er sponsoreret af Assets. Har din virksomhed brug for assistance med økonomi, løn og HR? Hør mere efter podcasten.
Kære lytter, da jeg for noget tid siden hørte, at Kees ter Hart, den hollandske topchef i Carlsberg, havde sagt op, og at han ville forlade Carlsberg i løbet af sommeren, så blev jeg nysgerrig. Jeg tænkte, hvad er det egentlig, at Kees ter Hart har gjort i Carlsberg? Siden at aktiekursen er steget fra ca. 600, da han tiltrådte for 8 år siden, og til nu, hvor aktiekursen er oppe i ca. 1100. Selvom Kees ter Hart efterlader sig en uløst opgave i at skabe sådan signifikant vækst, så er Carlsberg langt stærkere, end da han tiltrådte i 2015. Hvordan er det gået til? Og er der noget at lære af det forløb? Carlsberg er en ikonisk virksomhed. En unik virksomhed. Jeg har fulgt Carlsberg i mange år. Og jeg må indrømme, at jeg har et blødt punkt for virksomheden og dens historie. Jeg lavede mit første interview med Carlsbergs daværende topchef Poul Svanholm for mere end 30 år siden. Senere skrev jeg en biografi om topchefen Niels Smedegaard Andersen. Og når jeg går rundt i Carlsberg Museum i Valby og ser malerierne af de gamle medarbejdere, så føler jeg virkelig et historiens vingesus. I Carlsberg Museum hænger der 152 malerier. Det er malerier af medarbejdere, der har arbejdet mere end 50 år i virksomheden. Og det første maleri kom op allerede i 1896. Malerierne sender et signal om en for længst svunden tid, synes jeg i hvert fald, om loyalitet, om en livslang kontrakt, hvor en medarbejder dengang lagde sit fulde arbejdsliv i en virksomhed i en forventning om at få en livslang ansættelse, hvis ellers de kommercielle vilkår tillod det. Nå, det var et sidespring, et sentimentalt sidespring, men jeg blev altså nysgerrig, da jeg hørte nyheden om, at Kees ter Hart er på vej ud. Fordi jeg kender også hans forgængere, den tidligere topchef Jørgen Buhl Rasmussen og hans viceadministrerende direktør Jørgen P. Jensen. De to var kørt fast i en tilsyneladende endeløs række af sparerunder og et opslidende forløb med modgang i den store forretning i Rusland. Og jeg ved, at hverken Jørgen Buhl Rasmussen eller Jørgen P. Jensen er udygtige. Tværtimod, de er erfarne og anerkendte. Men det sker jo indimellem, at en ledelse kører fast simpelthen, og der skal en ny leder til for at få skabt noget ny energi i en organisation. Så jeg kan tydeligt huske, at da Carlsberg holdt en tiltrædelsesreception for Kees ter Hart, dengang da han startede, det var i Glyptoteket inde i København, så stod jeg i køen af gæster dengang og tænkte, gad vide, hvad der kommer til at ske. Gad vide, hvordan den nye, ukendte topchef vil gå til opgaven. Svaret på de spørgsmål kender vi nu. Og svaret er ikke, at han traf nogle få og spektakulære beslutninger, som vendte op og ned på det alt sammen, men at han traf en masse små og store initiativer. Sådan plejer det jo at være. I Carlsbergs tilfælde så er blandt andet meget andet fokus flyttet fra lande til forbrugere. Der er lavet en øget satsning på specialøl og på alkoholfri øl. Udvalgte brands er rullet ud i kinesiske storbyer osv. osv. Men hvad er den sådan ledelsesmæssige forklaring på, at det er gået, som det er gået? Her taler jeg med Kees ter Hart om tre initiativer, som set i bakspejlet har gjort en forskel. De tre initiativer er for det første, at han satte en ny dagsorden, og at det skabte en ny energi i en organisation, der var kørt fast. Det gjorde han ved at bryde med den målsætning, som den tidligere ledelse havde sat tilbage i 2008. Det var dengang, at man lavede det store opkøb i Rusland, og ledelsen erklærede, at Carlsberg skulle være verdens hurtigst voksende globale bryggeri. Efterhånden, som der kom problemer i Rusland, så var det umuligt at leve op til den ambitiøse vækstmålsætning. Det var lidt en offentlig hemmelighed, vi skrev også om det i Børsen. Men det var først, da Kees ter Hart kom til, at man tog sig sammen til at bryde med målsætningen. Han satte en ny dagsorden, mindre fokus på vækst og mere fokus på at skabe finansiel handlefrihed. Men især så løsnede han op for den spændetrøje, som den umulige målsætning havde holdt medarbejderne i. For det andet så valgte Kirsti Hardt at inddrage sin øverste ledelsesgruppe, kaldet Top 60. Han gav dem indflydelse, men han forpligtede dem også på deres resultater. Og i løbet af nogle få år, så var en tredjedel af lederne i Top 60 væk. Når jeg taler med nuværende og tidligere ledere i Carlsberg i dag, så siger de, at ja, det nye samarbejde i ledelsesgruppen Top 60, det var en vigtig årsag til Carlsbergs fremgang. Og for det tredje, så udnyttede han virksomhedens historie. Han brugte det, som man på nudansk kalder for founders mentality, om at huske, hvad det var, at stifteren af virksomheden, I.C. Jacobsen, ville med virksomheden, og hvordan man oversætter den ambition til et moderne Carlsberg. Kirsti Hardt og jeg taler også om tidens uforudsigelighed og om geopolitik, og om hvad han lærte af forløbet, hvor Carlsberg blev kritiseret for at være for lang tid om at beslutte, at man ville trække sig ud af Rusland, efter at Rusland invaderede Ukraine. Til sidst skal jeg lige oplyse, vi taler undervejs om to bøger, dem redegør jeg for i min afslutning. Når Kirsti Hardt i optagelsen taler om JC, så er det I.C. Jacobsen, han taler om. Og når vi hen imod slutningen taler om de såkaldt golden words, så er det det, som de i Carlsberg kalder for de gyldne ord, de ord, som I.C. Jacobsen skrev i sit testamente i 1882, og som stadig gælder i Carlsberg og i Carlsbergfondet i dag. Og de gyldne ord, de lyder sådan, citat: ved Carlsberg-bryggeriernes drift skal det stadig i formål uden hensyn til øjeblikkelig fordel at udvikle fabrikationen til den størst mulige fuldkommenhed, således at disse bryggerier og deres produkter altid kan stå som et mønster og ved deres eksempel virke til, at ølbryggeriet her i landet holdes på et højt og hæderligt standpunkt. Citat slut. Velkommen til Topchefernes Strategi. Kirsti Hardt, welcome to our podcast. Let's start with your first assessment, Carlsberg's situation when you started as a CEO. My notes from your visit in Børsen Executive Club in 2016. You said at that time, the glass was half full, a good position in 22 different countries, a growing volume share over the last couple of years, and you were premiumizing. On the other hand, the glass was half empty. You had underperformed financially. You had limited presence in key growth markets, and your EBITDA margins were below your peers. So based on this, what was your take on your challenge as an incoming CEO? What kind of challenge did you see?
Yes, well, we had a couple of challenges those days. We were in a so-called financial straitjacket. We were fully leveraged. The countries we were in had low momentum growth, and we did not have the funds to invest in these markets to stimulate the growth. We also had relatively high costs and lower profitability than our peers. And according to the analysts, we continuously overpromised and underdelivered. Hence, we had trust issues in the financial market. So the first topic we focused on was to ensure we got back to creating the flexibility to operate, meaning that we were able to invest in portfolio, in the competencies and culture, whilst being also able to satisfy the financial market and live up to our promises. And we called that funding the journey and put a target of 1.5 to 2 billion DKK as savings, of which half would be used for supporting the business and the other half for improving attractiveness for shareholders by improving margins and ROIC. And by that, we ended up delivering even 2.3 billion and invested over 1 billion to support the business. And this brought us back on track.
We will come back to all this, but I'm a little curious to start with. The former management somehow lost their way. On the other hand, they were experienced and respected leaders. So how did Carlsberg end up in this difficult position?
Well, I don't want to criticize predecessors, as that's always easy. But those days, I talked indeed about the glass being half empty and half full. So I think the over-dependence on Russia made it very difficult to come out of the negative spiral without a fundamental review of the business model. So while we did have a crisis, there were also positives to build on, like a number one or two position in many markets, having a strong, very strong route to market in most countries where we operate in. And these kind of number one, two positions are very important prerequisites for being successful in beer. So there were many positives to mention. But indeed, we had a difficult situation in Russia.
So an important learning from your very first assessment back in 2015 was that the challenge in Russia somehow dominated the thinking. It made it difficult to find a sustainable way into the future.
Yes, Russia was quite a big part of our EBIT, and we were not successful, and the market was under severe pressure. And hence we needed to come out of that negative spiral.
It was not only a financial straitjacket, but also a mental straitjacket.
Yes, indeed. Russia was a significant part of the portfolio, and that part was declining, and there was at that moment of time no market in the Carlsberg portfolio that could compensate for this, whilst competing brewers like Heineken and ABI operate in very large markets like Brazil, Mexico, Nigeria, with a positive momentum those days. So with Russia declining and no countries to compensate for this, it became mathematically impossible to be the fastest growing beer company in the world, which was basically the mission that Carlsberg was on.
It basically took a new CEO to see the company in a new perspective.
Yeah.
So the acquisition in Russia was not a mistake?
No. Nope. I don't think that was a mistake at all. At that moment of time, that was the right thing to do.
So the acquisition in Russia was not a mistake?
No, I don't think so. It was a good ad and basically made Carlsberg one of the larger brewers in the world. However, management those days did not have a lot of luck afterwards because of the change of regulations in Russia. And by that, the continuous disappointing results in Russia.
So it was more the handling of the difficulties in Russia, you could say, the following years, that you could say was a mistake?
Well, mistake. At a certain moment, you're in a kind of a vicious circle, and then sometimes it takes somebody else to be radical on the consequences of that.
Let's look at your most important management priorities as a CEO. The first one was setting your own agenda. When you arrived at Carlsberg had for some years had a kind of mission saying the fastest growing beer company in the world. And everybody also in the media, we wrote it in Börsen several times, knew that it was an impossible mission, but your predecessors stick to it. You very clearly dismantled it, stating that it was mathematically impossible. What were your thoughts on this?
Well, as we said earlier, Russia was a significant part of the portfolio, and that part was declining, and there was, at that moment of time, no market in the Carlsberg portfolio that could compensate for this, whilst competing brewers like Heineken and ABI operated very large other markets like Brazil, Mexico and Nigeria, and these markets have a positive momentum those days. So, with Russia declining and no countries to compensate for this, it became really mathematically impossible to be the fastest growing beer company in the world.
I've been told that your decision to dismantle this kind of mission had a strong impact internally. It released energy. However, it is unusual, in Denmark at least, to speak openly critical about one's predecessor. What were your considerations on this before you stated it?
If there is a mission that nobody believes is realistic, even mathematically impossible, I think as a leader, there is no other option than to call a spade a spade. It had nothing to do with my predecessors. Internally, the focus was definitely on the future and not on the past. And it wasn't spending a lot of time on why the glass was half empty or full. It was basically focusing on how to get out of the problem of profit warnings and a stressed balance sheet.
You also made a substantial change in your internal agenda concerning financials, and you mentioned it earlier on in this interview. You said that you needed to reduce your costs, but that you would reinvest part of these into the business. Was this a deliberate decision to strengthen the internal motivation?
Absolutely. And I must say, also before 2015, there was a good focus on costs. However, it's much more motivating to cut costs in order to fuel growth and create a future for your business than only cutting costs for what many people thought was the third Ferrari of the shareholder.
Were you surprised how much energy this single one decision created?
No, I've seen that before. Our colleagues at that moment of time had the feel that many of the brands were deprived of good support. And at the moment that you don't feed the cow, you don't get milk, so to say. So people had the feel that we really needed to support our brands and our business better.
I've been told that when you were about to reach the financial goals in funding the journey, not only the media, but also internally in the company, people were asking about the next step, the growth, but you did not want to open that discussion. You were very focused on the financial goals to the very end. Were you afraid of that a shift in focus towards growth would mean a loosening of financial discipline?
No, I don't think that's factual. In fact, I wanted to have and the savings, but also the growth. So indeed, the first 2 years we talked about funding the journey. But after saving 2.3 billion DKK, we started reallocating part of these savings into growth, like in alcohol-free beers, in Somersby, in craft, in 1664 Blanc, in China. And therefore, in 2018, we moved from funding the journey towards shifting gears to grow. And we indeed got the wind in the sails, and we indeed started to grow by over 4% organic in 2018 and 19. And then it turned 2020 with COVID and everything was different. However, we kept the concept of continuously focusing on lowering non-added value cost and using these savings to fund investments to grow.
So this concept of continuously focusing on lowering non-added value cost and fund investments to grow, it somehow became a mindset.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your second priority was aligning the management, not only the top management, but top 60. And one of your first initiatives was to invite your top 60 to Amsterdam on a sailing boat,
yeah,
where they were trained in sailing a boat. It was because you wanted them to become a team. Were they not a team when you arrived at Carlsberg?
Well, indeed, we rented a huge sailing boat and I invited the top 60, meaning our country leaders and those that lead the functions. And I wanted them to feel what it is like to sail a boat together. And we did some training in the morning and in the afternoon, we indeed sailed the ship as a team. And that was really a great experience. The underlying purpose, however, was to make a point to our top 60, the future will be different. We were, in my view, missing the sense of one overall leadership team for the company. We should not work anymore as a confederation of countries, but as one leadership team.
So when you arrived, there was a team in name only, meaning that there was teamwork, but it was in separate teams. You have used a soccer field analogy on this.
Yes. The soccer field analysis was that I had a feel when I came that we were, let's say that we were in 30 countries, that everybody was playing on his own soccer field. And I invited the people to look at this in a different way and to say, let's assume we are playing on one soccer field. And basically the people in the countries are basically the people, the attackers. So they're closest to the goal. They're the closest to the consumer, the customer. And they need to score the goals. And then you have the people like group commercial, group supply chain, that need to make sure that the innovations and the products are there in full, in time, if you like, to really score the goals. And then you have in the defense, legal and finance and so on. So it was really saying we are not 30 different companies, we are one company and we want to win the match.
Was this a new definition of the operative model in the company?
We didn't change anything in the organization. It was just another mindset.
I understand that the point was not only on this boat trip in Amsterdam, not only they should learn how to work together, you also gave each one an individual task, for example. What are the trends in beer? What is the potential of cider? What will be the growth opportunities in non-alcoholic beer, etc.? And 6 weeks later, you met again in Shanghai. What was the idea with this procedure to make them feel they had influence?
Well, it was basically three steps. So the sailing in Amsterdam with allocating the tasks, then having people working on that in teams, meeting in Shanghai to see what the progress was, and then finalizing that in Denmark in December when we were again together with the top 60. And basically, the reason behind this was that I really wanted to have everybody feeling responsible for the strategy. There were a few reasons for that. I was new in beer. We had very experienced leaders in the business with excellent category knowledge. So asking them to give their input enriched our plan. But I also wanted them to feel that SAIL22 was our strategy, not only mine. So our thinking about a strategy that is co-designed is also co-owned. And by that, we will embed faster and deeper in the company what the strategy is, and also bring results faster. So mid-2016, some investors visited a number of countries, and they were really surprised to hear the same story everywhere regarding SAIL22 and the priorities. And the fact that SAIL22 became so quickly visible in the results was mainly due to the involvement of this top 60.
So even though a strategy work like this will take a longer time, in the end, it will be executed faster.
Yeah, it's the famous sentence, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to come far, do it together. Yeah.
I've heard that you have been very focused on this, on the community and the loyalty within Top 60. Either you are part of the team or you are not a part of the team. I guess these leaders are very ambitious people, very big egos. How did you manage people like this to be team players?
Well, at the end of the day, people want to be part of a winning team, and we were clearly not winning those days. So I think three things were important in 2015. The leaders were invited to participate in designing the strategy, so the co-creation. We also agreed, and we talked about it openly, we agreed on a way of working which I called the triple A: align, feel accountable, and action. And there's a difference between being accountable or feeling accountable, because feeling accountable is an intrinsic motivation. I thought that was very important. But yeah, we had maybe the hearts and the minds, but also the wallets we needed. So we changed the incentive scheme. If we won, all leaders would gain from that.
So the incentive scheme became a more solidarity for the whole top 60. This, you call it triple A: align, feel accountable, and action. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, the feedback I got in 2015 was when a decision is taken, the discussion starts, and I felt that what we needed to do is to give people a handle how to behave. And indeed, of course, in a company like ours, you need to, it's not consensus, but at least you need to agree, to align on things. But also then allocate who's going to do what and should feel accountable for, and then making sure that it's really happening. And sometimes in the company, people stuck too much in the alignment and nothing happened afterwards, or they immediately moved into action, whereas more disciplines, more functions needed to be involved in it to really make it a success.
Was it also a cultural change in the way of working in a top 60?
Absolutely, yes. But we also went, so we came together three times a year those days. And one time it was not only the co-designing and the co-implementation, but also the co-learning. So the one time a year we were at IMD in Switzerland to discuss topics and to learn together. And also that, I think, was seen as a signal that I was serious about doing this as one team.
And also being serious, I understand that within a few years, one third of your top 60 had left the company. Why was that?
Well, most of them, if not all, were indeed asked to leave as they were good in explaining why they had not been able to reach the targets, opposed to changing their attitude towards real performance management and getting their targets. So keeping poor performance in the top team is the kiss of death for success over time. So yes, we have, or I have been candid in this.
A CEO of a Danish tech unicorn once told me that the single most important signal you can send to your high performers is how you handle your low performers. Maybe you agree on that.
Yeah, I agree on that. And of course, you need to deal with them with respect. Ultimately, they cannot remain part of the team indeed.
Internally, you often quoted the book Into Thin Air by John Krakauer about a failed attempt to climb Mount Everest. What inspiration did you find in that book?
For those that that don't know the book, I really would recommend to read it. It's a story of a mountaineer that wanted to bring a number of relatively inexperienced people to the top of the Mount Everest, and he wanted to make his business out of that. And whoever reads the story will easily find quite a number of leadership lessons, but one of the most important ones is to avoid a negative goal pursuit, so to say. Because as he wanted to make a business out of that, he had only one goal: bring the team to the top. And he had not thought through how to bring them down safely, like, for example, the NASA wanted to land a team on the moon those days and bring them back in good order. So translated to business, a company should not focus only on growth or only on improving margin or only on profit. To keep a business healthy, it's about what we in Carlsberg call our golden triangle. We need to keep the right balance between growth, margin and profit.
So this challenge comes with some complexity.
Yeah, I mean, if people say sometimes, especially in 2015, they said you need to choose between do we want to have a volume growth or do we want to improve the profit? I said basically there's three things that you're responsible for: to improve the volume, the margin and the profit. And of course, sometimes, and therefore it is a triangle, sometimes you need to keep these in a slightly different balance. So at the moment that you lose market share because you're too expensive, you might reduce your margin a bit and to make sure that you repair your volume. And the year after, you have a slightly different balance in the total mix. But at the end of the day, it's about managing this golden triangle.
So this one of the learnings from this book was not only to have a long perspective, but also that leadership is about balancing different goals among each other.
Yeah, I mean, it goes deeper in that book. It is defining success. So what is the top and what do we see at the moment that we reach the top? It's all also about what kind of capabilities do you need to have in the team to reach the top. Some people are great in climbing the rocks. Other can move quickly over ice and so on and so forth. And the other thing is, how do we behave as a team at the moment that we are on our way to the top? So there are different learnings to be taken out of that dramatic story.
Your third priority was taking advantage of the company's history. And of course, Carlsberg has a unique history. And you took advantage of that when you had a meeting in Top 60, when you had finalized your first strategic plan, SAIL 22. You invited the actor Flemming Enevold to interrupt a meeting playing the founder, J.C. Jacobsen. What message did he give to the Top 60 that night?
Yes, that was somewhere in December in 2015. And it was at the end of the 3 months that we prepared our plan, the co-creation of the plan. We started in Amsterdam, then moved to Shanghai, and then finalized our strategy workshops in Copenhagen, in the house of the founder. And indeed, it was at the end of the 3 days in which we aligned on the SAIL 22 strategy that I asked Flemming Enevold, a great actor, to address the team acting as J.C. Jacobsen, the founder. So at the very end of the meeting, when we basically that day said, is this our strategy? Are these our priorities? Is this the way we're going to do it? So we were talking about the why, the what, and the how. Then J.C. knocked on the door and asked whether he was allowed entering his own house, his own company. And he then made a speech on how strongly he felt about Carlsberg and how its purpose was relevant in the past, in the current time, and would remain relevant in the future. And he invited the team to bring SAIL 22 to life, and JC thanked the team for bringing his legacy forward. Now, obviously, the text was was more or less written by myself. But I must say, it was for many team members seeing the AC alive. It was, especially for the Danes, an emotional experience as they felt they had a responsibility making an iconic Danish company like Carlsberg successful again.
Was this a risky initiative? Could it have gone wrong somehow?
No, this one not. No, I don't think so. Well, maybe the non-Danes, so to say, could have seen this as folklore or something like that. But no, the Enevold is an excellent actor, and most of our people knew a bit the story about DAC. So they many of the, of our colleagues were touched by it.
This, I guess, comes back to the DNA of the company, to the very heart of the company, and to the question, why does Carlsberg exist? What is your answer to that question, anno 2023? Why does Carlsberg exist?
Well, first of all, beer is a social product. We bring people together. We create special moments in life with our excellent brands. And these brands are trusted, and people see these as also a friend, so to say. So you could argue that this is the same for all brewers, but still very important in times of polarization. What makes Carlsberg very special is that 30% of the dividends are redistributed to society through science and art. And that makes our people want to go the extra mile for the company.
You have found inspiration in the book called Founder's Mentality, which, and I know many Danish CEOs know the book. It's about the importance of remembering what the founder of the company wanted to achieve and create for customers.
Mm-hmm.
What inspiration did you find in Founder's Mentality?
Well, frankly, I was mainly inspired by the title. So when I came back from China in February 2016, I saw this book in the bookstore in Hong Kong when I had a connecting flight. And I immediately thought, this is missing in Carlsberg. And those days, especially, I would say, in the central office here in Copenhagen, we were not obsessed with our brews. Our customer service was not good. We were not taking care of our people well enough, as we had many accidents in our breweries. In fact, we had 5 fatalities in our breweries in 2015 only. So, talking about founder's mentality, our founder's mentality here at that moment of time was very different. And JC was obsessed with quality, put his customers first, and took care of his people. And he wanted to leave a legacy. So our thinking about translating his history, if you like, this into our purpose. And we basically articulated that later on as we brew for a better today and tomorrow. So today we want to bring people together to have a great time by caring for our brands, customers, consumers and employees. And we also want to contribute to tomorrow. So contributing to a better society with our Together Towards Zero and Beyond program and the fact that the more we earn, the more we support society through research and art.
So you have a why, and such a why and such a founder's mentality. Is that the same independent of time, or how do I make a historic why or founder's mentality relevant in a modern time?
Yeah, well, I think nowadays everybody talks about purpose. In 2015 was a bit different, but a purpose or the founder's mentality needs to have its own contemporary words. Otherwise, people might not find the purpose appealing. But the essence remains the same. So famous are JC's golden words about striving for perfection and giving back to society, which we translated into brewing for a better today and tomorrow. And regarding the tomorrow, we added our sustainability program to that, named Together Towards Zero, reducing carbon emission and water waste to zero. And I think that's a contemporary articulation, what is important for a sustainable society.
I guess that's a little bit unique for a modern company, that you have these golden words more than 100 years ago. They are still at a plate in the company.
Yeah, that's absolutely. So others need to, if you like, look for it and search for it. And we had it already. And that's that's a great advantage of this business. Absolutely true.
And how do you communicate that internally? How do you make sure that any employee, also in distant places and cultures and countries, knows the why and is motivated by it?
I think in the past, people felt a bit like this is a nice story, but it's nice for the Danes. And Carlsberg Group consists of many acquired businesses, breweries across our regions. And these were all founded, more or less, in the 19th century. And it's and that's the difference, I think. It's quite striking that many of these founders, those days, wanted to leave a legacy, like the Ringnes brothers in Norway, the founders of Feldschlösschen in Switzerland, the Kronenbourg people. And I could mention almost all our local power brands. So these were purpose-led companies avant la lettre. So by relating the purpose less to JC or a Danish history only, but relating it to their specific founder and their archetypal founder's mentality, all countries owned the purpose and felt inspired by it.
So E.C. Jacobsen's golden words, they resonate with other breweries around.
Yes, and the founder's mentality, if you like, in the second half of the 19th century was more or less all the same across the globe. It was about, and you have that, of course, with founders always, is about being obsessed by the customers and the quality and so on and so forth. But the brewers those days were more or less all focused also about leaving a legacy.
Finally, I would like to talk about your most important learnings from your time in Carlsberg. First, I would like to ask you about the important challenges we see in modern times, vulnerability and unpredictability. At the annual general meeting last year, you said everything has changed. And the last 3 years, you have experienced COVID-19, supply chain issues, higher rates, higher inflation, unstable energy prices, a war in Ukraine, and a boycott of Russia. This is a time of unpredictability. Also, for many years, companies have worked hard to become more efficient and lean by outsourcing, by having fewer suppliers, smaller stocks, etc. It has created value, but then we learned that it also made us vulnerable. So now the challenge is to become more robust without losing competitiveness. What is your reflection on all this? What are your learnings?
Well, first of all, when we were talking about Sail 22, and in fact, in our metaphor, like sailing, I raised the question to our team in 2015, what is our torpedo? In other words, what could sink the boat?
Did you ask that question?
Absolutely. And it is about what are the major risks, and also to ensure that the strategy we're choosing was robust enough for competition, for shocks, and so on and so forth. And since then, we have really been focusing on making our business more resilient, so that our ship indeed could survive different storms. And when you talk about resilience, in order for a business to be resilient, I think it should be healthy in four areas. First of all, we want Carlsberg to be financially healthy. So a business with a strong balance sheet is significantly more shock-proof, and we experienced that especially at the moment that we were experiencing COVID and later on the crisis in Russia-Ukraine. So the second point is that Carlsberg needs to be strategically resilient. The brands must maintain or grow their market share. If not, the business will die over time. The third thing is that there is an organizational health. Very important, because employees need to be motivated. Attracting and retaining talent is of essence for keeping a business successful. And last but not least, and frankly that came a bit later than in 2015, is the societal health. A business should have a license to operate and behave responsibly towards a net zero. So we distinguish four different lenses to make a company resilient.
But besides these four lenses, which I would call them very important, of course, but also a bit traditional, don't you need something more in the world we're living in to anticipate what's going to happen around the next corner?
Yeah, maybe they're traditional, but I think the fact that we have been able to start with a strategy, make our business more resilient in the four ways that I just described, frankly, I wouldn't know a fist or another element to make a business so resilient for the three storms we had in terms of COVID, the war, and later on significant inflation. At the end of the day, of course, is, and that comes back to the purpose, that there are people that want to safeguard the safety of the company, of the safety of the ship, so to say, whilst you sail through these big storms. And you can have any kind of model, but at the moment that you miss the morale of the crew, then you don't have any possibility to win.
I come back to that in a second, in the next topic. Just now I would like to ask you, did it come as a surprise to you how vulnerable a company, perhaps any manufacturing company, has turned out to be?
Well, I think the essence is, we talk about four lenses, four different health, but the essence is a strong balance sheet. If you start with that, that is frankly the prerequisite more or less for everything. And we were very not lucky. It was by design, but in that respect, it was good to have this strength at the moment that we got into these challenges.
Another topic is geopolitics. At the annual general meeting last year, you also said, in my memory, it looks binary, but the world is more complex. And I interpreted at that time your statement as an observation that we are living in a more unpredictable world now, and especially when it comes to geopolitics. And I guess geopolitics has become a new and important challenge for a CEO. And in my subjective observation, the present generation of CEOs are not trained in this. They are used to live in a more linear world with numbers and figures, but in a binary world, you need different capabilities. You need musicality, and you need to be able to think like a politician, maybe, and you need to communicate in a different way than before.
I guess if you look through the history and also look back over the last 20 years, the businesses have not been that linear. But I guess the last 3 years have been the most challenging years for CEOs. I agree with you. And especially the CEOs in Europe, with three huge unknowns: COVID, war in Europe, and unprecedented inflation in Europe. That required a lot, and as many businesses, and that's what we need to note, many businesses came out relatively well. So it shows that business leaders have been able to lead their business in very unprecedented situations.
But did you experience in this situation that you personally needed some management capabilities which you did not possess?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, was very specific in Denmark, if you like, is that we have been very much challenged by some newspapers about our decision, or basically the so-called late or delayed decision about moving out of Russia. Well, I think that it's fair to say that business leaders so far followed politics with regards to trading in foreign countries. As long as there were no boycotts or sanctions that prohibited doing business, you would be in a country. Regarding the war in Ukraine, this has been very different. Media forced businesses to take a firm stance. I say media, but basically it's media, social media. And these forced businesses to take a firm stance of leaving Russia, whilst politicians only talked about allowing doing business as long as companies adhered to the sanctions. And frankly, I am not sure we as business leaders, but maybe it's better to say I as Carlsberg CEO, have been able to communicate well enough the enormous complexity in this very new territory of having large businesses in European countries that are in war. So in 5 weeks' time, we concluded to leave a country that represents 10% of our turnover, that was acquired in 2008, and that still is considered as the largest M&A deal a Danish company made. 5 weeks, with all employees, legal, shareholder, financial complexity. And still, we were heavily criticized. So, at the same time, I'm not sure that media were interested enough in the context and the complexity of leaving a country. So, on face value, it looks an easy binary decision, but it is significantly more complex.
But Case, what is your reflection on this? If it would happen again, would you again be very surprised, or have you adjusted your communication policy to be better at explaining the complexity of a modern international company for the public and for the media?
I think, if I may be brutally honest, there's a Danish perspective in this. As you know, I'm Dutch. I live in the Netherlands during the weekends. And the scrutiny of companies doing business in Russia has been significantly higher, and the pressure also in Denmark than in maybe Sweden also, but than in any other country that we deal with or that we trade in. So it maybe I've underestimated, if you like, the stance that social media in Denmark would take on this. On the other hand, still we're talking about 5 weeks for and at the moment you've seen our announcement afterwards. We need to have a huge write-off. But more importantly, we have 8,000 people also in Russia working for us that supported us in good and in bad times. So yes, it took us 5 weeks to put that all in balance, the social aspects, the humanitarian aspects, the legal aspects, the relation with the banks. And also, of course, the relationship with the shareholders. So it is a complex topic.
But I accept completely that this is very complex. And I also accept that 5 weeks actually was extremely fast. But still, I would like to challenge your point of view, because what is your reflections on this, given the time, if it would happen one more time? Have you adjusted your communication policy, or have you adjusted something else in the company's policy towards society?
I'm a self-critical person. So at the moment that newspapers and others have the feel that I did something wrong, I look at myself, and it's the easiest way to say, well, the journalist or the social media are wrong. But reflecting on this deeply and in a serious way, I must say that I feel, if you go back to that time, the only way that I could have satisfied the media at that moment of time is to say, at a too early moment, we move out of Russia. And what I mean is too early, then we would have gotten an uproar of shareholders, basically legal claims. We would have run out of the bank covenants, and the company could have been on its knees without cash. So people, I think, really underestimate the complexity of that. So, frankly, as long as people only want to hear what they want to hear, then there's no other way than just to follow your own moral compass and come to a conclusion at the moment that you have taken everything into account, because at the end of the day, I'm responsible for the continuation of this company.
This also, I guess, raises questions to you as a modern leader. We talked earlier about management capabilities. In this very unpredictable political environment Carlsberg has been in concerning the debate on Russia, management capabilities in the future, do you also need, as a CEO, to show your team that you don't have all the answers, that you are in doubt sometimes, that you are vulnerable? Because especially young people, young talents, expect those kind of characteristics from their leader.
The fact that I started in 2015 with co-creation gives already the feel to the team that I don't know it all. And I think the world has become too complex to have the imagination that only one person knows it all and could come to all the right decisions all the time. So rather than saying that I know it, I think what I say to our people, to our team, at the end of the day, it's about you, I. We need to lead by our own compass. So with all the opinions that are around from employees, board, media, shareholders, and so on and so forth, you need to make sure that you get all the inputs. You need to be vulnerable in terms of saying at a certain moment that you might not know. But as a CEO of a company, you need at a certain moment also to come with a decision. You've paid for that. And there, I think it comes back to remain close to your own compass. And any decision I make, I should feel that I can defend the decision from a rational, an emotional, and a moral point of view. And only then, I think, I can stand the heat of the kitchen.
You have been CEO for many years also before you arrived at Carlsberg. Do you see in the young generation of modern times that do they have different expectations to the capabilities of their leader than, say, 20 or 30 years ago?
I think they have a very strongly developed compass. I think they're broader in their, let's say, capabilities than my generation. Also, of course, when you talk about digital and adaption to new technologies, I think they also have a better understanding that there is more in life than being CEO. So the balance of life is probably also better developed in that generation. So I don't have any doubt that next generations will continue to do well, if not better.
Kiss the heart, we are about to end. Before we end, have you anything else to add, some final words before leaving Carlsberg?
Well, yeah. It, especially as a foreigner, a Dutchman, it was really an honor to work for such an iconic Danish company as Carlsberg is. When I was appointed in 2015, I heard a story that there was a big disappointment that more than, I think, those days, what was it, 160 years, there was a Danish CEO and suddenly there was a foreigner. I'm told that the Danish society was at least glad that it was not a Norwegian or a Swede. So in that respect, I was accepted for a while. But it was really an honor to work for Carlsberg. It has truly been a privilege working with so many talented, committed and purposeful people. And I will miss dearly the company and look back with pleasure and pride.
Kees ter Hart, thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Det var denne udgave af Topchefernes Strategi. Et forsøg på at blive klogere på tre af de initiativer. Det er i hvert fald min iagttagelse, der har gjort en vigtig forskel i den turnaround, der er sket i Carlsberg i de seneste 8 år. Om at skabe en ny energi ved at sætte en ny dagsorden, og måske lige så høj grad i virkeligheden at bryde med den dagsorden, som alle kunne se, ikke længere var realistisk. Om værdien af at skabe et nyt mindset i en ledelse og gøre det ret konsekvent. Kees ter Hart kalder det for et dødskys for succes, hvis man accepterer en dårlig performance i et ledelseshold. Og om værdien af at udnytte en virksomheds historie til at formulere det, vi på nudansk vil kalde et moderne purpose. Jeg noterede mig også, at når jeg stiller Kees ter Hart det spørgsmål, som jeg stiller alle topchefer, som jeg møder i den her tid, nemlig i en tid, hvor vi er blevet sårbare og skal gøre os mere robuste, hvad er så dit bud? Så svarer han, at han bruger 4 såkaldte linser. For det første at have et stærkt finansielt helbred, han kalder det for a strong balance sheet. For det andet at være strategisk robust, det vil i Carlsbergs tilfælde blandt andet sige at have stærke brands. For det tredje at være organisatorisk sund, især sådan at man kan tiltrække og fastholde talentfulde medarbejdere. Og for det fjerde at have en såkaldt license to operate, at være accepteret af det samfund, man er i. Og jeg noterede mig, at da jeg spurgte Kees ter Hart, om disse 4 såkaldte linser er nok, og man har brug for mere end det i en uforudsigelig tid, så svarede han nej. Han ville ikke vide, sagde han, hvad en femte eller en sjette linse skulle være. Og når det gælder kritikken af Carlsberg i forhold til Rusland, så noterede jeg mig den frustration, som ledere i store danske virksomheder indimellem oplever, når de føler, at en dansk offentlighed og også en dansk medieverden ikke forstår den kompleksitet, som et moderne privat erhvervsliv opererer i hverdagen. Og jeg noterede mig i øvrigt ikke, at han og Carlsberg har ændret deres kommunikationspolitik som følge af kritikken. I sidste ende, sådan hører jeg ham, så må en topchef gøre det, han eller hun mener er nødvendigt at følge sit eget moralske kompas. Lige tre afsluttende bemærkninger. Vi talte om bogen, der hedder Into Thin Air, og som er skrevet af John Krakauer. Den bjergbestigning af Mount Everest, som den handler om, den fandt sted i 1996 og endte i en katastrofe og med adskillige døde. Vi talte også om bogen Founders Mentality, og en af bogens to forfattere, James Allen, har været gæst her i podcasten. James Allen fortalte her om Founders Mentality og om, hvordan konceptet har udviklet sig siden, at bogen udkom. Du kan høre optagelsen med James Allen stadigvæk, hvis du søger tilbage til 2. februar 2022 her i podcasten. Og så har jeg selvfølgelig spurgt Kiste Harts forgænger, den tidligere topchef i Carlsberg, Jørgen Bull Rasmussen, om han har nogle kommentarer til sine år i Carlsberg, og især til det, som Kiste Hart fortæller om at bryde med Jørgen Bull Rasmussens målsætning, fordi den var, som Kiste Hart siger, matematisk umulig. Jørgen Bull Rasmussen har takket pænt nej til at kommentere Kiste Harts udtalelser. Tak til Kiste Hart. Tak til Arjuna Alexander Koldbur Sørensen, der redigerede optagelsen, og tak til dig, der lyttede med.
Podcasten var sponsoreret af Assets. I Assets har vores mål altid været det samme. Vi skaber ro og tid for dig og din virksomhed, så I kan fokusere fuldt ud på jeres kerneforretning. Derfor assisterer vi virksomheder i hele landet med alt inden for økonomi, løn og HR, og vores viden, erfaring og digitale løsninger gør os til en ideel samarbejdspartner. Læs mere og kontakt os på assets.dk. Vi hjælper dig med at fokusere på det vigtigste.